Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this week's FX Podcast. In this podcast, Mike Seymour is going to talk to William Labida from Picture Mill about main titles for feature films, television, trailers, studio and production company branding logos, network IDs. You've absolutely seen lots of their work. But before we get to that, I'd like to tell you about what's been going on with the FX Guide crew. I'm sure most of you know of the Visual Effects Society. If not, head over to visualeffectssociety.com and check it out in more detail. Mike, John, and I have been members for many years and really support what they're doing to raise the profile of our industry, the respect for our industry, and of course, we really see eye to eye on education, sharing of ideas, and respect for the craft. So every year, VES presents a festival of visual effects where they do 3 days of panels, screenings with questions and answer sessions, stuff like that. So this year, for example, they had a panel on previs, one on miniatures, one on special venue projects, and then they also do things on specific movies like Shrek the Third, Spider-Man 3, the Pirates of the Caribbean series, just to name a few. But let me tell you about my favorite session, and this is just my opinion, and even then, I'm not too sure I can really narrow it down to one, but they were all great sessions. So imagine on one stage, John Dykstra, Richard Edlund, Ken Ralston, Dennis Muren, Douglas Trumbull, and the moderator, none other than John Knoll, who, by the way, deserves high praise for doing back-to-back sessions. He did the Pirates of the Caribbean session right before this one, which was also outstanding. So imagine that list of visual effects legends chatting for an hour and a half about the top 50 visual effects movies. It was fantastic. So this year, we were honored to work with VES to help them videotape these sessions for archival purposes. John Montgomery came out to Los Angeles, and with the help of a great group of FX PhD postgrads, we videotaped all the sessions, in high definition, I might add. We're now working with VES to incorporate sections of these into some FX PhD classes. And we got to interview people afterward from almost every panel. You'll see some of that if you're an FX PhD student. And we'll also be using pieces of that in a new project we'll tell you about very soon. I have to add a personal note. It was also a pleasure to meet so many of these people as we interviewed them. Hearing so many people speak so passionately about visual effects was invigorating. So while John and I were here doing this, Mike was also busy in Sydney on a shoot for an upcoming FX PhD class. He also took time to have the following conversation with William Labida at Picture Mill. They've done main titles for movies like Mission Impossible, The Panic Room, iRobot, Dreamgirls, War of the Worlds, as well as studio branding title cards for Universal, Mandalay, Spyglass, Amblin. It's a long list. Let's join Mike now.
Thanks for that. And William, thanks for joining us. Where are you based at the moment?
I'm sitting in my office in Hollywood, California.
In the middle of what is obviously the film capital of certainly America and predominantly a cultural point for most films for the world. Now, your work often leads the films of Hollywood in the sense that you obviously do work in terms of title design, film marketing, and a lot of work even with live action and stuff. Are you conscious of the role culturally that the company plays?
I think we're aware of the projects that we work on, and sort of some of them have more and less significance than others. You know, not every movie is going to win an Academy Award, and not every movie is going to be, you know, a box office smash. So I think there's some awareness to that. I don't think that we take too much, you know, I don't think we worry too much about, you know, our cultural impact, though I'm not sure that we'd, you know, take a movie that is somehow morally really reprehensible.
I mean, I guess from my point of view, it's almost like a pop culture thing in that as you define graphically many of the stories that are going to be things that you work on, you obviously design has a huge role in that sort of cultural aspect of visual perception.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, that part of what we're doing in movies, and especially as, you know, effects get more and more elaborate and we're able to do more and more things and, you know, express ourselves in bigger ways, I think we do certainly have, I think we make a bigger dent than we think, and, you know, we've even done titles for movies that have ended up, you know, leaking out and being, you know, ripped off for commercials, I should, you know, that where they've become, you know, like Panic Room is one I think that people really look at as being a title sequence that then you could see where how its influence, you know, went, just permeated through, you know, car commercials and grocery store commercials and McDonald's commercials and, you know, and you can all point to the same thing, which is, you know, a title sequence for a main title for a feature.
Well, I mean, it's funny you should raise that. I was going to bring it up later because, for me, that really was a classic case. I myself had sat around saying so many supers are just visual graffiti placed over the top of work, and they have no bearing to the work underneath. And through Panic Room, when, as you say, that's just spread now into mainstream advertising, there's been such an integration of supers and titles and text information into the communication, into the stream, into the ad. How did you guys come up with that in the first place? Where'd that come from?
Well, that was something that we had worked with when we had first met David Fincher on the project. He had had sort of this vague idea of, you know, so much of the movie takes place inside, in the dark, in the rain, in the middle of the night, that he wanted to have the bookend of the movie be outside in the sunlight, sort of in his mind, I think. The kind of descent into madness and then the kind of coming back out on the other end. And so, you know, really wanting to get a sense of New York, a sense of being outside, a sense of scale and scope of the city, that when you spend the rest of the movie inside a room, you don't forget it's like a New York room, and that's significant for various reasons to the film. So that was, you know, he kind of come with a kind of vague sense of it, but then we had to really solve the problem and really make it a reality, because there's legal issues involved with how big titles can be. You know, he was talking about putting shots where you couldn't put cameras, and just, you know, the trick there was, you know, executing it at a level that it was going to be believable and magnificent and sort of shocking in its believability.
Well, now, I was going to talk to you about film titles later in the interview, but let's keep going. No, let's go on it, because I think it's fascinating.
Sure.
First of all, just on that specific sequence, a lot of the stuff in that looked like you just shot it from some kind of steady system off a helicopter, but in fact, there were 3D buildings in there, weren't there?
There was a tremendous amount. We worked with a company called Computer Cafe, which is now called Cafe FX, which are tremendously successful and talented friends of ours up in Santa Maria. And they were, you know, they did a lot of photogrammetry where they were projecting, you know, captured still photos against geometry that they'd built, you know, rebuilding parts of the outside of buildings, you know, texture mapping them with photographs, but then, you know, building the iron staircase on the side of the building so it, you know, move correctly. It's actually probably, I think, all said and done, probably 50-50. I think, you know, half digital fabrication and half live action. And in fact, there's one shot that's actually it's a still that's just being panned. But I won't tell you which one it is.
You were talking about David Fincher and his role of establishing New York in that title sequence. And what I was going to ask you about, in titles, there's often a large amount of screen time because there's obviously a large amount of titles coming up, but you're not normally got any dialogue going on. So it's an opportunity to actually tell some of the story, but from a completely different point of view than we'd normally see. And I'd suggest that, you know, that's particularly the case in the War of the Worlds stuff.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We don't even really think about... We never really thought about those being titles about the War of the Worlds. But it's really... It's a prologue and an epilogue. It's really part of the movie. It's actually, you know, the fact that we have a couple cards that say, you know, DreamWorks Pictures presents War of the Worlds, and then you go into this long sequence of editorial and the people talking, or with the Morgan Freeman's narration over the city shots and the effect shots. You know, it's not really titles. I mean, it really functions as a prologue. I mean, and it was, the copy itself was even taken from the first and last pages of the novel. It was rewritten, obviously, for the 21st century instead of, you know, prithee here and heretofore and whatever was written, you know, 1860 or something. But it really was, we were telling a part of the movie, telling the story
absolutely
of the movie.
Vital part of the movie, actually, yeah.
Yeah, it's like it's the setup and the wrap-up to the picture.
Yeah, totally.
And he's, you know, but again, doesn't want to spend time... You know, the story that Steven decided to tell is a much smaller, intimate interaction between this guy and his family and these aliens. You know, he didn't really want to take it to a global perspective. And so what we were able to provide was the global perspective. And it passed that, even the planetary or the galactic perspective of, you know, there's this little blue dot out in the world that's being coveted by this, you know, other alien intelligence that's, you know, while humans go around blindly, the whole, you know, this other whole culture is looking to subsume Earthlings and use them for whatever their nefarious means are. But, you know, he never really talks about that in the movie in the rest of the picture at all. You know, you never have, you know, Tom Cruise never expounds upon, oh, they must be here for our natural resources. He doesn't care. And that's not even the story that Steven was really interested in telling. But if you didn't have that, it would be a chase movie. It might as well be a haunted house movie.
Well, yeah, and of course the payoff on the virus thing is all tied in with that as well.
Exactly.
So that begin. I mean, because obviously you could do a film title sequence that is almost a graphic design treatment that is not in any way related to the rest of the film. Of course, you do the film an injustice. So, what I'd like to discuss with you now is how you approach a project like that, because at the stage that you're working at, the film isn't really made. It's presumably, will you get involved when it's being partially shot, or where would you come in?
That one, most of the time when we do main titles, and that really is the bulk of our work, we're coming in fairly late. There's often a rough assembly of the movie, but maybe it's not fine cut edited. You know, they've got sort of a sense of how it begins, but they don't really know for sure. That's often why we get called, is because they don't know exactly what they're looking for. We recently did a title for, which has a completely different kind of main title on it, called Vacancy, which is kind of this thriller chase movie, where they'd cut the movie and they felt like it just didn't have a robust enough beginning, and it didn't really set the stage for what they wanted the audience to feel as they were going into it. And so we created this graphic world of kind of this maze of typography that's very claustrophobic and big, but it has this kind of Bernard Herrmann sort of sounding score. So it's kind of thrilling and exciting and changes a lot. And it kind of leads the audience into the movie in such a way that, you know, they're getting excited and anxious about what's about to happen, and it just really leads them into the picture. And yet we haven't really done any storytelling. What we've done is we've set a tone and a mood for the audience without necessarily giving any of the details of the picture away.
See, I think that's fascinating, because the words you're using, like claustrophobic, and you're looking for an emotional response from the audience, and yet most other people, when they're approaching titles, would be thinking about, well, what's it going to look like, and being much more mundane as to color or light and dark. And you're coming at it from, this is the emotional response I want the audience to feel. And claustrophobic isn't a word you'd, if you weren't a designer, you'd associate with film titles. So my question is, how do you work with your clients to get from, I want a title for this film, to, aha, we want an emotional claustrophobic response from the audience?
I think a lot of that comes from the movie itself. You know, they bring us in and they screen the picture for us and they say, you know, it feels a little this. You know, it's a little flat. We wish it was a little something. We wish it was a little bigger at the beginning. You know, they may not even be able to use words that are all that instructive. But as designers, and especially experienced designers, you learn to kind of read through in between the lines of what they're saying. Then we had the opportunity to see the movie, and you realize, oh, we know what we need. We need to get everybody all agitated before the movie starts. So we understand, as filmmakers, separate from graphic designers, we understand and begin and try and express the, like you're saying, the emotional response of what feeling do you want the audience to have as they're going into the beginning of the movie. And so what happens is you talk with the director and the producer and the editor, and they say what they can tell you about it, and sometimes they're very, very specific, and sometimes they're much more vague. But most of the time, they approach, when we become involved, especially when we're going to do more of a standalone sequence, they're coming to us as filmmakers and storytellers, and they're looking to us to kind of help them solve that little bit of storytelling, or to communicate that extra little bit of emotion that maybe it's not quite coming through the way they like it to in the beginning or in the ending. If titles at the end, you know, we can have much more sort of celebratory situation or something. But it really is, you know, that's something that they come to us actually looking for, that experience and that collaboration to deliver a response to the audience as they're going
I mean, obviously, it would change on a client basis, and excluding a situation like War of the Worlds, where it's very integrated. But when they first come to you, is it mainly that they're after the title, as in a typography thing, and it builds out from that point? Or is it much more for you that once you've got the theme of the visual design, be it live action or computer graphics, then from there, the typography of the actual titles falls?
I think every case is different, and that's one of the thrilling things, I think, about the work that we do, is every film is different, and every director is different, and every story that they tell is different in a different way. And, you know, sometimes we're doing a title where it's, you know, some simple typography over scene, where it's really, you know, they've got the beginning worked out the way they want it, and it's working editorially, and it's working with the music, but what they need is they need a little bit of animation, or they want a certain kind of typography to tell you something about the picture. You know, maybe it's a period piece, maybe it's a historical piece and it needs a very elegant sort of feeling to it. Maybe it's punchier and more fun and needs something a little lighter and fresher and, you know, brighter colored. And that there's those kinds of films where it's more of a type, just a straight type over scene. And then, again, it's, you know, the movie's doing as much informing us as what the client's looking for. At that point, we are looking at you know, more of a typographic solution, or looking at something where, you know, we're going to make a logo that says, you know, movie X, and it has to, you know, you look at that and you have a certain feeling about it when you see it, and trying to make something that's a logo and not just a little, you know, not just setting it in Times Roman that says, you know, movie of the week or something.
Do you try to make it emblematic? Do you try and make the titles emblematic, or is it more, because presumably by the time the audience is there, they know what they're seeing, right? So it's less about readability and more about style, or not?
I think it's really about, I think legibility is always important, but that's just, you know, a typographers, you know, feel like if you're going to bother to make it, you should probably make it readable. I think, you know, somewhat emblematic is certainly the case. I mean, I think people, you want something distinctive. You want something that feels like the movie. You know, that if it's a big comedy, you're not going to have a really elegant typeface. You want something that complements the movie. And sometimes it gets more of a logo treatment, and sometimes it doesn't. But I think most of the time we're pretty sensitive about that and try and make the title stand out from the rest of the typography. And the title, you know, whether it's the shot that we pick to put the title over, something to say, you know, here's the title of the movie, now the movie's starting, please pay attention.
I guess for me, there are some of the work that you've done that was, I mean, great, like Mission Impossible, but the idea of a fuse is a well-established piece of iconography for that whole franchise. But then there's things like iRobot and some other stuff that you've done where it seemed to me that it wasn't what I was expecting. You cut across where I thought one would naturally go because there are some obvious things that you can do with some of those things. And they are obviously the most interesting, but are they also the hardest to sell? Or is a good idea just tend to grab people and, you know, the theory book goes out the window?
Good idea tends to sell. You know, and in fact, the best idea almost always tends to sell. I think your observation about Mission Impossible is really good, because there was a number of attempts early on working with, working with J.J. Abrams to reinvent the fuse and to try and think of, you know, more, you know, completely different ways of looking at it, much more radical. In the end, we looked at it. And we looked at the movie, and we were talking to JJ, and we said, you know what we really need? We need to shoot the car commercial of fuses. You know, we don't need to reinvent the fuse. We just need to make it the coolest, slickest, most modern fuse you've ever seen. You know, get the camera just as close to the lens as you can, shoot it, you know, super slow-mo, shoot it super high speed, you know, whatever we need to do to just really explore, to see it in a way that feels fresh, and at the same time, like you're saying, it's still established. And if you didn't have the fuse at the beginning of the movie, you'd be really disappointed, I think, as a film goer.
Well, they own the fuse. I mean, the fuse says Mission Impossible.
Exactly. And so, but then when you go to a film like, you know, so it was challenging in its own way, because it was, you know, how do you make the fuse the greatest 21st century fuse ever? But again, it was a gimme in some ways, because it's like, well, it's going to be a fuse thing. So I think we'll just work, why don't we just spend our efforts working on a fuse ideas. But you're right about iRobot, you know, that movie, which in my mind, isn't really, you know, it's kind of a sci-fi movie, but to me it's basically a detective story. And I think the way that they treated it was like a detective story. So, you know, our approach at the beginning about being much more mysterious and not so mechanical, and it's like about light and shadow and strange shapes and things kind of coming in and out of the darkness and the weird red light that, you know, which in the end turns, of course, to be the scary monster of the movie, is when all the robots get the red light. You know, that really, that came out of the fact that when you watch the movie, you realize the movie's kind of a detective story and not like a big smash-up Transformers flying robots gag. And I think that, you know, that's just a whole different approach. But, you know, we went through the whole, you know, we did things that were more robotic and had, you know, more what you would expect. Like you're saying, things that were more obvious and expected. But in the end, that was the idea that stuck with everyone, just top down.
Now, we talked a bit about emblematic and iconography and the idea of the fontography of the opening title itself, but the market has moved in the sense that trailers now often have teaser trailers, and almost the only thing going for them in the teaser trailer to give you a personality or take on the film can be the title, because quite often there's some either gag or some aspect of it that's almost showing you nothing of the real film.
Right.
And these teaser trailers, probably more than anything else, are relying on the look of that end title of the film to give you some hint as to the nature of the film. Have you found that to be true, or am I sort of...
No, I think you're very correct. And I think it's a very astute observation that I think much of the title treatment tells you about the movie. You know, you see, we're working on a couple things here, you know, one of them is Beowulf, and the work that we've been doing for Beowulf has been based around this mark that was developed through this really, you know, back and forth long process over at Paramount and, you know, with their various people that they work with, and I know that Zemeckis was very involved as well. And, you know, in the end, that's what tells you much about what that movie is. You know, and you may not even know what Beowulf is or who Beowulf is, but, you know, a couple of shots on that piece of typography tells you that this is this big, mythic, epic story, you know, on the scale and tone of Lord of the Rings, and being done in a completely different way. But it, so much of it, you're right, comes from the fact that it looks a certain way, and you look at that and you say, I know what that is, or I know sort of what it's like because I'm familiar with some parts of that. And it's the familiarity of, that's one of the things I think film marketing actually trades on, for better or worse, is familiarity. You know, if I make something that looks like something else or smells or feels a little like something else, you're going to understand what that is. It's a little bit of genre filmmaking, actually. It's a little bit, you know, sort of genre typography, I guess, that helps tell the audience what the picture is and what it's about.
Yeah, I mean, that translates also to the print posters. I mean, many of the teaser print posters are just almost the title of the film and nothing else, and
right,
you know, coming summer or whatever. So tell me, what's the role of your company, or what role does your company play in feature film marketing beyond the things we've discussed?
Well, you know, years and years ago when we started in 1995, we originally were almost strictly a film marketing company. We were doing graphics for trailers. And that was only through the hard work of myself and my partner, Rick Probst, did we kind of force our way into doing more and more of the main title work. But we're still very involved in feature marketing. We did entire marketing campaign for Mission Impossible 3. We worked on Dreamgirls. What was a couple of things we did? We did a bunch of stuff for War of the Worlds. Not only, and in fact, that was actually how we got to be doing the main title. We're working on the prologue and the epilogue was because of our work on the marketing campaign, brought us some awareness with Mr. Spielberg, who then, you know, the ball kind of started rolling, and then, you know, we got in and actually were able to do some work.
And quite a quick moving ball from all accounts.
yes, that was quite exciting to be a part of that. But our interaction with marketing comes at different points. You know, we've done some work where somebody will bring us almost a finished trailer and say, we need some graphics that, you know, do a certain thing, or, you know, we have a title treatment that's come from, it's the title treatment that comes from the poster, and the poster has been, you know, out for four or six months already, so that's got to go at the end, but we need to do the title reveal, and it's got to cut into the shots a certain way, and we see an edit from the marketing, the advertising company, feature advertising company.
We started the discussion to talking about culture, but there's also a responsibility, and that responsibility, I guess, is that you're trying to deliver an audience to a film, and all you can really do is get bums on seats, and then after that, the film obviously has to succeed or fail. But there's a responsibility, because if you set me up to think that I'm seeing a thriller, and I see something that isn't a thriller, it can be the sort of disappointment of not getting my expectations fulfilled colours negatively my response to the film. Had I been coming to the film with the right expectations, I probably would have liked it. So there's a real role there for you to make sure that the pitch of the film feels good in that marketing campaign.
And I think that that's something that's really, you know, one of the things that the internet has changed is I think there's a lot smaller grace period between, you know, you see a trailer and you go, oh, the trailer is kind of interesting and I think it's evocative, and then somebody goes to see that movie and 5 minutes after that movie's over, the review's on the internet and it says, you know, the trailer was a lie, it's not funny, it's not this, it's not that, save your money, stay at home. And there are people that read that and go, oh, well, fine, I'm being lied to, forget it, I'm not going to participate in that. And I think if anything, it's made just what you're talking about, that honesty about this is really what the movie is. We may spin it a little bit funnier or spin it a little bit darker or make it a little more romantic, but at the end you really have to be delivering what the movie is to the audience in the trailers. Because what happens
then,
is you're gonna get bit later. You know, and it is, as you say, it's going to color the experience of the film goer, where they're going to see something and say, "Hey, I thought I was going to be seeing, you know, this, but instead it's that."
Because in the example you gave a moment ago, which I know was just a make believe, but in that example, it wasn't that it was a bad film; it was just not what I expected it to be, and that alone is enough reason to be angry.
Yeah, and I think especially in the culture of people who, you know, put things out on the internet and participate actively in that culture of, you know, immediate online reviewing and communicating through the internet, the pendulum swings wide and fast. And I think that people have a tendency to, you know, overreact and things like that. I wish I had a really good example of something where I think people felt like they were duped, and I can't really put my finger on anything.
I think there are occasions where films have almost put all the funny scenes that they've had in the trailer, and it's almost like, well, you know, I would have expected a lot more, and I got...
And instead it's like, oh, all the good stuff was just in the trailer.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, when 300, have you seen the picture yet?
Oh, yeah.
You know, one of the comments that a lot of people said, it's like, well, it was just like a two-hour version of the trailer. And my feeling was, yeah, that's why I went. You know, I was hoping it was 2 hours of the trailer. You know, I didn't think, you know, I don't know what you were expecting, but I sure wasn't surprised. I sort of thought we knew exactly what we were getting into. But, you know, that's the other reaction, like you're saying. We've done some work with Adam McKay and, you know, Judd Apatow's guys over there. And, like, on... The Talladega Nights?
Right, yeah.
One of the things that I know that they were saying is that what we tried to do is actually take to things that we would edit out of the movie, that's what they would give to the trailer guys.
Well, I was going to raise that, actually, because that's a really interesting point. Trailers used to be cuts out of the film, but now we quite often have stuff in the trailer that isn't in the film.
Right, and part of that is because, you know, they're getting dailies early, and the schedule's really compressed. You know, they're trying to get trailers done earlier. The production schedule and the films are shorter. The world of the Avid and digital technology has really changed how quickly that world all works now. And because of that, they, you know, well, here's some stuff, or here's an early cut of the film, and they're going to cut a trailer out of it, and some of those things may not even make it in the end. And I just think it's subversive and sort of delightful that these guys that are working, you know, were working on Talladega, they were saying, you know, we're actually not going to use that shot, so we're going to give it to the trailer guys, just so the people in the audience don't feel like, oh, it was all in the trailer. You know, they were actually thinking of the audience and the audience experience of saying, I don't want to see, you know, it's funny in the trailer, and the cut may be a little bit different, or, you know, it's not going to be exactly the same as it shows up in the movie. So I think that it's just, you know, sort of trying to be sensitive to the audience in some ways with the marketing. It's not completely taking all the fun out of seeing the picture.
So in the two examples that we've discussed so far, where you're talking about title setting the emotional response for the film, and then in the trailer delivering an accurate feeling for the film, you've got a very clear story-related direction. Now, I want to spin you to the third thing I want to talk to you about, which is branding for production companies and stuff, because here you have a completely different problem. Here you have to create a title-y thing that will go in front of a whole bunch of different films.
Right.
And that's actually a whole different problem.
It is, and it's actually work that we really like doing. It's a work that we've done a lot of, and I think we're very successful at it. And part of that is because, you know, it's a collaboration. You know, you got to be willing to go into these meetings with these people. That sounds so derogatory. Go into a meeting with a client, with somebody who needs a production company logo, and you really have to say, you know, I'm going to bring some of my ideas to this, and I'm going to do my best to help you, but in the end, you're really branding somebody else. And, you know, there's a lot of personal feelings involved, and it's like a really emotional, loaded situation that you're going into, and you have to be really sensitive that, you know, these people are basically putting their name for the world to see and sort of hoping people will like them. So you really have to be, you know, sensitive to what other emotional feelings that the client is bringing to that.
So and I read some research that said that of all the film companies, the only one that had the most distinctive single positioning brand is Disney. You know what you're seeing when you see a Disney film, right? It's going to be a Disney kids film, right? It's like, and if it isn't a kids film, it isn't a Disney film. You know, it might be one of their other brands. Okay, so, and with that in mind, clearly something like the Universal studio opener, or for that matter, say Spyglass, I mean, they're really nice treatments, but they're fairly, you know. But then you get to something like Dark Castle. Now, that's really not going to work well over in front of a kids' film, right? That's like, now is that deliberate? Is that like that they're happy to?
You know, that's actually a really perfect example, because when we worked on that, the idea was it was a genre film label. Those guys were only going to make horror movies that cost a certain amount of money, and so they basically wanted a horror movie logo. And, you know, completely, you know, there's never going to be a comedy, there's never going to be a romance, there's never even really going to be an action movie. I mean, they were going to be basically making straight-ahead horror movies. And the idea was, you know, that's what we need to brand these as. And unlike something like, you say, Spyglass or Red Wagon, where there's a much broader umbrella of types of films they're putting that under, I mean, those guys were a genre label, and I think continue to do so and really embrace their original vision for the company.
I think there's something else interesting, if I can kind of get ethereal again for a second.
Please.
I'm sorry to do this to you, but I mean, for me, there was station IDs on television, and they were often a graphic sequence and no live action and very kind of just branding a logo. And then they've kind of evolved over the years, but then by the same token, we haven't always had production company animated treatments like the ones we have now, and they've grown in complexity, and yet they're operating obviously on a different, well, for a start, a different aspect ratio. The old network stuff was 4:3, and this stuff's obviously got to work. What is it, like, what are the limitations? What do you sort of, how do you sort of see the limitations, if you like, or the constraints on that type of work? I mean, for a start, it has to be obviously pretty short. And
well, that's the biggest thing I think now is with the amount of co-venturing and co-funding and, you know, studios working together to make movies, which, you know, even 20 years ago was just unheard of. You know, now DreamWorks and Warner Brothers may get together to make a movie, and Warner Brothers will do the domestic distribution, and DreamWorks will do the international distribution, and they, you know, they share the funds and they share the production costs, and so that now in the beginning of the movie, you have two 22-second logos at the beginning of the film. So then, if you throw in a third production partner, or the, you know, the star's production company or something, you know, you're talking, you know, upwards of 30 or 40 seconds, and the movie hasn't even started yet. You know, the movie comes up, and you're just logo after logo after logo after logo. And I think that the companies that need these production company logos, or these guys are getting more and more sensitive to that and realizing, you know, 10, 12 seconds is plenty, and maybe we're not even going to end up using all that much on the picture. But it's just, you know, knowing that how many of these things are going to go in front of a movie really could, you know, gets tedious for the audience. And so I think that's one of the biggest things, is just the fact that, you know, you string too many of them together and it's just, you know, a minute worth of just blah, blah, and you haven't even started the picture yet.
Let's discuss that phase, though, because that's if we assume for a second that we're going to have you designing a unique piece of footage that is just used, as I say, in different films. But there's also a trend, certainly in the studio playouts, and I've seen this a lot with Warner's, but also with Paramount in particular, of actually doing some kind of new version of the traditional studio playout that then actually continues. You fly into the mountain of Paramount, and it's like a different version of the Warner Brothers logo that is related to that individual film. And I'm wondering, is that going to happen with the production companies, as I call them? Is Mandalay going to start doing the tiger, you know, turns into something that is the thing?
A zebra? That's what I really want to do. I want to reduce black and white stripes instead of orange stripes. I don't know. And in some ways, I actually think that it's actually harder to do those kind of unique logo treatments when you have three and four logo companies. On, you know, 300 is a good example of something where they had, I think they must have had four logos on the front, but they were almost just like the static icons, and they rebuilt the whole background, and they put them all over the same background. I know that they did something similar to that for, I think it was Batman Begins, where they kind of color tinted them all the same way and did some, you know, effects to it. You know, but it does get more challenging when you have, you know, that much content to deal with. You know, before, when you wanted to do Warner Brothers and a Dark Castle logo, you could, you know, turn the Warner Brothers logo red and it sort of cross dissolves into the Dark Castle thing, and then you go into the movie. But if you have more than that, it just really it becomes more and more challenging, and it gets harder to do things like flying into the Paramount logo. If you have two other production company logos after it, you can't do the gag. So in some ways, the limitations are, it's kind of taken some of the fun out of some of that, because there are so many of them. In terms of what, you know, though I think the other thing that is changing is that I think studios are becoming to be more sensitive about it, and you don't have to necessarily play out the whole logo. You know, Warner's is one that's been very flexible about, well, we can just take sort of the, you know, short little section of it, or, you know, as long as it's equitable between all the product, you know, them and the production companies, they see it and approve it. They've been very flexible about that and giving us some chances to shorten and condense that into a little smaller experience for the audience to have to sit through.
So just finishing up, that's what I wanted to touch on, what you just hit on there, which is the approval process. Because I'm guessing, and I have no basis in fact for this, but I'm guessing the most complicated approval process would have to be upfront studio production company playouts, because it's their stuff. It's very, you know, we don't want to be longer or shorter than the next guy. And
right.
I mean, is that true? Is that the hardest thing for you to get approved?
It's normally what happens is that, you know, when we're working on a feature, you know, the logos will be just delivered from whoever's made the logos. So often it's not such a problem. The tricky thing has been, I think we did, and I cannot verify this for a fact, but I think we did the last time anyone got to treat the 20th Century Fox logo is when we put Lightning and Thunder in the Clouds behind it for Day After Tomorrow, because that you know, not far from them, we went to go do iRobot for them, and we wanted to do kind of an underwater thing, and they said, nope, head of the studio said, no more. 20th Century Fox logo is the 20th Century Fox logo. It needs to play clean. It needs to play with the audio, and that's the rules. And, you know, their pendulum swung the other way, where it's like, that's it. No more monkeying around with that. It's got to start, finish, and play exactly as it's supposed to. I think most of the time, the studios like it when the filmmakers engage the whole process that way. We're doing some titles for a movie now called Shoot 'Em Up, and we're doing a treatment to the logo it was something the director had presented to the. The director had presented it to the studio, and they got excited about it. So for us to do it, it was just kind of executing something that they were already excited about. And it wasn't a big approval process. But, you know, I think the studio is willing to embrace a filmmaker that they're working with. And if they're bringing it to them and saying, this is why it's important, and we think it's, you know, going to add something to the picture, I think they can be pretty flexible about it. Now, in terms of doing work and getting something to be approved or getting something finished, production company logos are the most difficult. Those personal logos for a company where, you know, this is, you know, a guy and his wife that have been making movies for 10 years and they finally get an opportunity to put a logo in front of the movie. And, you know, they'll just agonize over, you know, is it represented right? Is it too fast? Is it too dark? Is it too slow? Is it too red? Is it too green? You know, it just these, it's like their children, you know, and they're packing their children off to send them to college or something. And it's really, and it's a tough thing emotionally. And we've done a lot of them, and it's hard. And it's the hardest thing to do ever. You know, we suffer the same thing as a design studio ourselves. You know, branding ourselves is the hardest job we'll ever do. And I'm, you know, I think we do an okay job at it, but sometimes I wish we could hire somebody.
What
else.
Font did you pick for yourself?
Oh, we're
Avenir.
Very nice. No, we're Avenir these days. We Avenir. It goes with our round gear, round circles, round gear. For a while, we were Futura, but a little thorny. We liked kind of how friendly the Futura, the Avenir is, and it comes in lots of weights, so we can have, you know, big thin type and small fat type. And,
now, be honest, how much fussing was there on the kerning of your logo?
You have no idea. At one point, I think there's actually three versions of the gear with different number of teeth on the gear. How about that? Where it's like, I think right now we have 11, and at one point there was 13, but the teeth were too small. And at one point there was 7, but they looked too fat, and it looked like a Tonka truck tire. It's, you know, it's just... you could drive yourself crazy. And then sometimes we look at it and go, should we turn it 3 more degrees? I don't like the flat edge. It seems so, you know, it's, you just drive yourself nuts. And so we actually all take turns. The latest iteration was done by one of the designers down the hall, and he kind of had a whole vision for how to do the website and some of this other stuff. And I said, "Great, you seem to be under control. I'm going to let you do that. I'm not going to get in there and fuss with it because you just drive yourself crazy."
Well, look, we've really enjoyed talking with you, and we really enjoyed your website. It's very clean.
Oh, thanks.
And so whoever that was, say thanks from us.
That was Grant, by the way. Grant did that.
Well, again, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so that'll do it for this week's FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser for John Montgomery on his way back to Chicago, and Mike Seymour. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2007 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.